And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman, on this Wednesday. Well, today we open discussion of immigration issues on our program. We'll visit with Alvaro Vargas Llosa. He's a senior fellow of the Center on Global Prosperity at the Independent Institute. He's been an op-ed page editor and columnist for the Miami Herald, and a featured writer in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times. He's also the author of Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America, and he joins us from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Mr. Llosa.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Hi, good. Great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to talk about immigration as a divisive issue in earlier times, when it was a source of great hostilities in the U.S., and I'm thinking about the Irish, the Italians, and the Jewish immigrants, to name a few. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, people sometimes get the impression that this is really a recent issue for America and for other countries, but no, this has always been an issue in the United States. The proportion of percentage of the population that is of immigrant origin in the U.S. today is roughly the same that it was in the late 19th century and the early 20th centuries. And at the time, there was a very hot debate about what the best way to stem the flow was, the inflow. And they came up with all sorts of laws and restrictions that targeted particular groups of people, individual groups, singular groups of people. For instance, the first target was the people of Chinese origin when they came to California in the 19th century. Then it was the Japanese. I mean, some really severe laws were basically aimed at them. And then in the 1920s, there were more general laws basically restricting people coming from Southern Europe and Eastern and Central Europe as well, as opposed to Northern Europe, which is where people in previous waves had come from. So this is really an old issue.
Bonnie was talking about immigration of the early 20th century, the Ellis Island kind of immigration. You say it's similar. How do you gauge that that immigration wave versus today, say, through Mexico and South America is the same?
Well,
or similar?
One of the really important turning points came in the 1880s. I mean, between 1830 and 1880, it had been mostly Northern Europeans. And then after 1880, it was mostly people from Southern, Central, and Eastern Europe, including Italians. And that was a big shock for Americans. At the time, that was seen as something that was threatening both from a cultural point of view and from an economic point of view. These were people who were seen or perceived as having a very different type of cultural background, people who were more low-skilled than their predecessors, who were not going to contribute to the economy, were going to take jobs away, were going to degrade, as it were, the cultural fabric of the nation. And you can, I mean, I've read the press, what was said in the press at the time, and the kinds of stereotypes that originated at the time. They were horrific. And that eventually led to the first really restrictive laws on a general sort of level. I mean, there had been restrictive laws before, as I mentioned earlier, aimed at the Chinese and then the Japanese. But for the first time in the 1920s, there came about a set of laws that really were aimed at stemming the general inflow. And that was basically because of the type of immigrants that I was talking about just now. So that is kind of similar to what we've seen in recent years with all these different efforts to try to stem the inflow of people from Mexico and Central America, although not just them, but of course, because they constitute the largest group, mostly them.
How would you compare today's immigrants and contrast them to previous generations?
It's always been the case that people who came to America mostly came, although that was, of course, something that, it's too general a statement, but it was mostly the case that they came to establish themselves because they were fleeing from something, usually economic hardship at the end of the 19th century and early 20th centuries. Before that, of course, religion had to do with it as well. But mostly in the late 19th and early 20th century, it had to do with economic issues. Well, a significant part of immigration in the last, say, 20 or 30 years has had to do with economic conditions back home. That meant that when they came in, just as is the case today, many of them would tend to be people who would kind of gravitate towards the kinds of industries where low-skilled workers, very labor-intensive industries where low-skilled workers were needed. And so there was this tendency to look at them as people who were basically at the lower end of the scale, who had a low level of education. And as I said before, some of them seen as people who had cultural kind of practices that differed from the mainstream of American society. In time, of course, people moved up the scale, and they came to be seen as people who had contributed to the economic welfare of the nation. That is why, you know, today we celebrate Italian immigration, for instance. But people forget that at the time, Italians were seen just as many people perceive Mexican immigration today, and the kinds of things that were said about them are pretty much the same things that are said about Mexicans today in terms of education, you know, cultural level, and of course the space that they occupy in the economic fabric of the nation.
Many Americans worry that with the implementation of new health care benefits and increased immigration, that U.S. taxpayers will be holding a very big bag.
Well, I looked at this in depth, and there's really nothing to be very concerned about, which doesn't mean, of course, that there isn't a problem with the, I guess what we could call it, the welfare state. But that's generally more a problem with the welfare state itself than with the role that immigrants play in it for very different reasons. One of them, of course, is that the average age of illegal immigrants today, and if people who are undocumented today became legal tomorrow, this is a very relevant group in the discussion, which is why I refer to them. They are, on average, 27 years old, as opposed to 42, which is the average age for natives, for Americans. So these are people, of course, who are going to be contributing a lot more than they're going to be taking out for many years from the system, from the transfer system, if you will. It's also the case that they pay currently local and state taxes. People don't always realize this, but they pay everything from gas to real estate taxes. They also pay some federal taxes, including Social Security, believe it or not, which is why the government estimates that they pay about $7 billion into the system. I should mention that several studies have been conducted about the level of use of certain government services that immigrants make. And it's very interesting to note that, for instance, when you talk about Medicaid, immigrants use Medicaid, even though, of course, a large proportion of immigrants are not well off. They use it much less regularly, with much less intensity than natives, which really means that if Americans were to use it in the way that immigrants use it, the program would cost about 40% less. This was a study that was conducted very, very recently by the Cato Institute. And let me just finally mention, of the many studies that have been made trying to estimate what legalizing immigrants who are undocumented today would mean for that for the transfer system, perhaps the most authoritative study that was conducted more or less recently was done by the National Research Council, and what they did is they estimated the next 50 years, in other words, the net present cost of the next 50 years of both what they would contribute and what would they take out. And the number that came out of this was very positive. It was $80,000 in net contributions. And that includes people who are low-skilled. So Generally speaking, immigrants are not a problem when it comes to the welfare state, which is not to say, again, that the welfare state has not gotten completely out of hand, but that's a different issue.
I'd like to talk about assimilation. You say it's a three-generational process, but it seems that assimilation and Americanization used to be pushed upon immigrants more quickly than it is today. What were your findings on that?
Yes, I mean, there was this very interesting, I was going to say a program, but it wasn't really a government program. It was more a general social attitude throughout the nation called Americanization. And this came about precisely in response to the influx of Southern and Eastern and Central Europeans in the late 19th century and early 20th century. So what it was basically a general climate around the nation that kind of pushed people towards assimilation in terms of learning the language, in terms of learning the customs, being familiar with the, you know, the most basic history and the values on which the nation was, the country was, the republic was built. And this was highly effective. There were excesses, of course, but generally speaking, it was. Very, very effective and I think very successful. That, of course, in time was lost. In part, multiculturalism had to do with it. After the Second World War, this new paradigm emerged whereby, there was this tendency to look at all values as equal and all cultures as equal, and therefore trying to impose one upon the other what was, of course, no longer acceptable. And so we went kind of to the other extreme, whereby it really became, people became sort of guilty of even thinking that it was necessary to make people who were coming in from overseas familiar with these values that the Republic had been built on, and even with English.
What about technology? Does that also figure in with today's immigrants, that they can still maintain contacts with loved ones and friends at home by cell phone, email, Skype?
Yes, that, of course, has changed, the frequency, but not the nature of the contacts. Because I looked at, for instance, other Latin groups, such as the Italians, for instance, and it was interesting to note that back then, Italians were in contact with their home, with their families, and with their homes, incredibly intensely. Of course, they didn't have cell phones back then. They were using the means that they had. They were writing letters like mad, and they were always expressing this huge nostalgia for back home. And many of them wanted, just as some do today, wanted to make some money, stay here for a while, and then go back. But that's only partially true, because eventually what happened was that most stayed here, and of course their children took up root in the country, and the three-generation process you mentioned took place, just as it does today. So the technology plays a part, but it doesn't change the nature of the contacts and the relationships.
We're speaking with Alvaro Vargas Llosa. He's the senior fellow of the Center on Global Prosperity at the Independent Institute, and he's the author of Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America on today's Topical Currents. A short break, and we'll return and take some calls and some emails.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Alvaro Vargas Llosa about his book, Global Crossings. If you'd like to join in, we'll open up the phones. 1-800-743-WLRN. 1-800-743-9576. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. And is the Twitter working?
Yes, it is working now. It's at Topical Currents.
Tell me, Alvaro Vargas Llosa, what are the politics involved with the Republicans, immigration reform, and gaining Hispanic voters? And could you give us your opinion on the situation of Florida Senator Marco Rubio and the turmoil that's going his way from Tea Party members?
Well, this is a fascinating debate. I've had the chance to talk to him a couple times, and I think that he's engaged in a courageous battle. It's a very tough one. I wouldn't, dare to predict what's gonna be the outcome of that. But I think that it's really important that the wing or the sector or the segment of the Republican Party that is fighting for a new vision on immigration really carry the day, because the only way I think that the Republicans are going to be able to make up some of the lost ground throughout the country with Hispanics, and not just Hispanics, by the way, other immigrant groups as well, including Asians, who have been voting overwhelmingly for the Democrats in the last few years, is by persuading them that they don't have this hostile attitude that many immigrants or children of immigrants seem to think that they have. And it's really important that the outcome of that debate really prove that. Otherwise, I think they're going to be in trouble, because we're now talking about more than 10% of the electorate. So it's becoming very significant.
You know, just staying in Florida for a moment, you've said that people in Florida generally perceive that not as many immigrants attempt to learn English, but that your research says otherwise. What do you feel accounts for this disparity between what, you know, maybe Floridians perceive and the reality?
Well, many factors. One of them, of course, is the fact that you continue to have an influx of people. So if every year, in the last few years, by the way, that this is the numbers have dropped, very significantly. But let's say in normal times, not in times of recession, you have a continuous influx of people. So obviously every year you're going to have a number of people coming in who either don't speak Spanish or don't speak Spanish very very well. So that's why in certain areas where people tend to those first generation newcomers tend to concentrate, you might have that impression. But all the statistics, and I've looked at this really carefully because it's a major issue, indicate, first of all, that at least 40%, so, you know, not far from half of them, are familiar with English. They speak some English and they're able to kind of get by. And that once they come into the country, the process of assimilation in terms of language takes place exactly in the same way that it took place before. The second generation speaks English. They're usually bilingual, but they speak English better than, if we're talking about Hispanics, better than Spanish. And by the third generation, the irony is, of course, that they only speak English by and large. Of course, there are exceptions, I'm sure, but all the statistics are overwhelming. I mean, by the third generation, it's English that they have adopted almost exclusively, which is exactly what was happening 50, 60, and 70 years ago. Of course, if you live in a particular town where you have this constant influx of people every year, then you might get a different impression, but that's not really what's happening.
What do the polls show? Is it true that more voters really want stronger border enforcement than a path to citizenship?
Well, it depends in what parts of the country. If you're talking about Arizona, then probably that's true, but not everywhere. There are many other parts of the country where people want both at the same time, and even in some parts, of course, with where people are more familiar with immigrants, they tend to want legalization as quickly as possible, mostly for economic reasons, I would say. The issue of border security has become so entangled with the immigration debate that it's probably politically unrealistic to think that you can pass any kind of immigration reform without involving border security in a major way. However, I do think that is a problem in two ways. One way is that because we get sometimes bogged down in the discussion about border security, we fail to make progress where we really need to make progress, which is in immigration reform per se. And the other issue is that there's always a tendency to think that throwing more money and increasing the number of patrol personnel is going to solve the issue. And really, since the 1980s, we have been beefing up border security in various ways. Last year, about $18 billion were spent on this. And yet you still have this significant number of people who are in the shadows, which really means that we need to find another way so that we don't generate conditions that push people towards illegality, because border security per se has not been able to stop the inflow of people who are coming in illegally.
You've said that the immigration laws in the United States are disconnected from reality. I'm wondering what you mean. Do you think the quotas and restrictions on immigration are unrealistic? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think if, you know, it's always very difficult to determine exactly how many immigrants the U.S. economy, if we're talking about the economy, needs. But let's say, you know, in any given year, the economy needs 600,000, 700,000 immigrants. If you cap the number of people who are allowed in at, say, 400,000, 500,000, there's going to be a huge incentive, both for people in the U.S. who need their work and for people outside of the U.S. who need to work for those U.S. employers to match each other, to find each other in the marketplace. And that incentive is so powerful that it is able, and it has been for many, many years, to basically get around all the obstacles that have been placed in the way of those relationships. And the you know, proof of that, of course, is the fact that we're talking now about 11.5 million people who that are in the shadows. So rather than more bureaucracy, more patrol personnel, we really need to think in terms of how do we establish a flexible enough system that in those years in which you need 600,000 people rather than 300,000 people, you can get as many as that, and vice versa. I mean, there will be years. I mean, for instance, now in recent times, the number has dropped very, very significantly. You just need a system that's able to adapt itself to reality, in ways that I think have not been true in the last few decades, even, you know, ever since the Reagan amnesty in the 1980s, where they established quotas and caps that really created conditions for a significant number of illegal people, of undocumented people, work and operate in the country, even though that same amnesty had supposedly gotten rid of the problem by legalizing those who were already here, those, you know, 3 million plus people.
What about the dream individuals who came to the countries as babies or toddlers through their parents, but of course matured in its system? We've had valedictorians in high school threatened with deportation. They just grew up in the system.
Yes. Well, as you know, that was a very big debate a few years ago. So the Obama administration decided eventually to give them a 2-year work permit. And so that took care of the problem temporarily, of course. What they're trying to do now in the bill that's under discussion, that was approved in the Senate and is trying to make its way to the House, although it hasn't gotten there yet, what they're trying to do is to establish a path towards citizenship for them. And at the moment, at least in the version that was approved in the Senate, what they're doing is that those people who came into the country when they were under 16 would get a sort of provisional status, and they can apply for a green card up to 5 years, as opposed to people who are older than that and would need to wait 10 years to apply, not for citizenship, sorry, for green cards as well. Not for citizenship, because this is a confusion that is very extended. It's really just for green cards, in other words, for permanent residency, not for citizenship. So again, we don't know what's going to happen in the House, but at least in the version that was approved in the Senate, there is a system that's kind of quicker, if you want, for those who came in under the age of 16.
Again, we're speaking with Alvaro Vargas Llosa, Senior Fellow of the Center of Global Prosperity at the Independent Institute. His book, Global Crossings, on today's topical currents, and another short break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's topical currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're visiting with Alvaro Vargas Llosa, and he's a senior fellow of the Center on Global Prosperity at the Independent Institute and the author of Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. And a very famous father you have. A caller would like you to talk, asks if you're related to Mario Vargas.
Yes, he's my father, yes.
And he, not only a writer, but he also ran for political office.
He did a long time ago in 1990 in Peru. But he hasn't been involved directly with politics ever since. He's a writer, and that's really what he likes to do. And he's still writing.
Yeah, he is still writing. How old is he?
He's 77.
Oh.
He lives in Europe most of the time, spends a couple of months a year in the U.S., but teaching and so on, and lecturing, but it's mostly based in Europe.
I'd like to talk about your journey to America and the process you had to undergo to come here.
Well, I was hired by the Independent Institute, which is a think tank, a public policy institute based in California. I'm based in Washington, D.C., but they're based in California. I was invited basically to write a book about Latin America, about the reforms that had taken place in the 1990s. This was about a decade ago. And I spent about 2 or 3 years doing that, including publication and promotion and so on. And after that, I moved to the East Coast, and we opened an office in D.C. And I established myself here with my family. I am now a senior fellow with the Institute. I do many other things as well, but I have been basically looking at Latin America and the Americas in general from the vantage point of D.C., so I travel very intensely in the region. But I'm based in D.C., which is, of course, a very cosmopolitan place, and a place which is convenient for somebody who does my kind of work, because you have a lot of multilateral bodies, and of course the government is here, and a lot of embassies, foreigners, and so on. But I do travel a lot in the country, and this is a country I love very, very much.
And what about your affiliations with the Miami Herald in the past? What were those?
Oh, I was with them a long time ago. This was in the early 90s. I was in Miami for a couple of years. This was, I guess, 93, 94, mm-hmm. 95, almost 3 years. I was the op-ed page editor for the Spanish version of the paper, but I was also a contributor to the English version, and took part in their meetings and so on. And it was a really fascinating experience at the time, because that was the period when, of course, this is kind of ancient history now, but it was the period when there was an intense discussion about whether to separate the two papers or not. I mean, people might remember that the Spanish El Nuevo Herald, the Spanish version, used to circulate as a kind of supplement of the Miami Herald, and then eventually they separated. I was of the opinion that they should. A lot of people were of the opinion that they shouldn't, but eventually they did, and it was interesting to see the development of that.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in our discussion, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org, and you can tweet us, that's @topicalcurrents. First caller, we've got Pablo. He's in Jupiter. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So my question has to do with America becoming a majority-minority country in the next 3 decades. We will be a majority-minority country, and that's different than in all the past situations where immigrants, quote, assimilated, end quote, into the mainstream. In this case, ethnically diverse Americans are going to become the new mainstream. I'd be interested in your take on how that changes America and the need for diverse leaders and top leadership in America for the present and future prosperity of America.
Sure, it's a very interesting question that Pablo poses. I would, first of all, caution against looking at minorities as one group. I mean, they are so diverse, so different, and the of course, the similarities might be you know, more generally perceived than their differences, but really they are very, very different. And so what is really happening is not so much that the minority is going to become the majority, but essentially that the country is becoming more and more diversified, just like other parts of the world are. The so-called mainstream America is going to continue to be a very, very large group, if we can speak of a group, if we can speak in those terms. And not only that, but I think the process of assimilation, as I mentioned before, is following pretty much the same patterns than in the past, which really means that even though ethnically society is going to become and is already becoming a lot more diverse, and that, of course, is going to have some implications culturally, generally speaking, the essential values and the language that the country was built on, I think, are not going to be significantly threatened at all. I mean, I see a tendency for these various groups to assimilate into those values, even though we will see, you know, in cultural terms, greater diversification, just from the point of view of the food that we eat, the clothes that we wear, and so on and so forth. But that was always the case in the United States. I mean, the changes that took place between the 1880s and the 1920s and 1930s, vis-a-vis what had happened in the mid-1800s, were very significant. Today, we look at those as part of the general legacy of mainstream America. So one day, we will look at the last 30 or 40 years as having, you know, been part of the process of building the kind of America that we will have, you know, 30, 40, 50 years from now. And that will still be considered something that is rich and that is that has, you know, enhanced the values of the nation. So I wouldn't look at that process with any, you know, kind of a fear, but mostly with an open mind.
How much do you believe fear of change or just fear in general contributes to this conversation about immigration?
I think it's a major factor, and I've seen it in other parts of the world. I've seen it in my own country, in Peru, of origin in Peru, and I've seen it in Spain, where I've spent times, and I saw it in Britain, where I studied. This is really a very important part of the discussion. A lot of people tend to rationalize fear, and some of the arguments that we hear about immigration really originate in a kind of fear of the other and fear of that which we don't know. And then we tend to make up these important arguments basically because we look at this from a position of fear. So I think that those of us who are in favor of immigration and who can see the enormous contribution that immigrants make to U.S. society need to be more persuasive in making the case so that we allay some of those fears. And if we ever achieve that, I think everything else will be so much easier. I mean, just persuading people with arguments is going to be so much more effective once we're able to put those fears to rest. But for the moment, I mean, we have to admit that fear is a very, very important part of this.
One thing I note in your book, you note that immigrants possess this unique entrepreneurial spirit and work ethic. But do you find that they mostly hire their own ethnicity and not Americans that were born here?
Well, it depends where. I mean, of course, there are certain parts of the country that have large concentrations of immigrants. So simply because of the law of probability, it will be the case that a lot of people would tend to gravitate towards companies and employers who are of the same origin. But that is something that has always happened. I mean, when Italians or when the Irish or Central European Jews tended to, when they immigrated in the United States, they tended to work for people who were of the same origin simply because they tended to settle immediately in places where there was a large concentration of them. And eventually they spread out and they fanned out across the country. So this is exactly what we're seeing today. What is interesting to note is that you mentioned entrepreneurship, and It's interesting to note that about 12% of immigrants are self-employed, which is a similar proportion to that of Americans, of natives in the country. And if we look at specific industries and some of those high-tech industries that have been very much part of the modern economy of late, it's interesting to note that the contribution made by immigrants has been simply colossal. I mean, between a third and a fourth of new startups in industries that have to do with technology and have to do with computing and have to do with the software industry and have to do with science and bioscience, all of that has been, you know, of immigrant origin. They have employed so many people who are not just immigrants, but natives, English-speaking natives, that really I think it's a mistake to look at it in those terms. We really need to look at it in terms of how much they have contributed to the economy. I mean, Silicon Valley would not be what it is today and what it has been in the last 20 years were it not for the contribution of immigrants. That has been simply amazing.
Again, we're speaking with Alvaro Vargas Llosa, and his book is entitled Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. On today's Topical Currents, one more short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Alvaro Vargas Llosa. We're talking about his book, Global Crossings. And a reminder to our listeners that we'll have links to his book at both the Topical Currents Facebook page and also on our website. That's WLRN.org. If you go to those sites, you can quickly link to the book. Tell me, Mr. Llosa, about where African Americans fit in this picture. Is there still some resentment of Hispanic immigrants taking things away from African Americans?
Well, unfortunately,
or Asians as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, some of that exists, and I think that is one of the major challenges that leaders in both communities and Asians as well actually have. I think at this point, it's probably fair to say that it's not as intense, it's not as bad as it used to be. There's been some progress there. But unfortunately, that is still part of the issue. You can see that in some of the surveys and polls that have been taken. I quote some of them in the book. There tends to be among some African Americans the perception that Hispanics are here to take their jobs away, and it seems to be among some Hispanics as well the perception that African Americans are kind of hostile to them, and vice versa. I mean, there's no one side that's to blame here. I think it's essentially basically misperception on the part of some people on both sides of the divide. There is no truth to the idea that one group threatens the other economically. What has tended to happen in those cases in which Hispanics have taken the jobs that some African Americans used to perform, African Americans have moved up the scale, sometimes slightly, sometimes more dramatically. And so, yes, it may be true that they are taking some of those jobs, but what is not true is that they're displacing those who used to take them before. It's just
that
the dynamic...
But there's such high unemployment rates among African American younger males.
Yes, but that was the case before. There's no kind of cause and effect connection there. The fact that in some neighborhoods you also have a higher number of Hispanic unemployed people than you do in others probably speaks a lot more to the general business conditions in that particular area than to the proportion of people of a certain origin that are taking certain jobs, simply because the economy is an incredibly dynamic process. Although, however, the perception is definitely still there in some quarters, and we need to speak to that.
Let's take another call or two. We're getting sort of close to the end of our program. I ask our callers to be brief. This is Ray in Miami. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I've got a few comments here. One is there was a caller that was concerned about minority growth in the United States. But isn't that actually a positive with the white population declining? We're going to need an increase in population for this country to continue to grow. I'd like to also ask you about crime within Hispanics. My perception is that their crime rate is very low. And I also have an issue with the racist policy that we have in this country, because we have no concern about a Canadian border, a Canadian wall. There's nothing there, and it's porous as can be. One last thing is most immigration, I believe, comes in from, like illegal immigration, comes from people overstaying their visits when they fly in here. Can you address those issues, please? Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. First of all, in terms of the growth of the minorities, there is a perception out there among some people that the birth rate among Hispanics is very high, and that is a contributing factor to this general phenomenon. And that is no longer true. It used to be true. It's no longer true. The birth rate among Mexicans and Central Americans is only 60% higher, less than one baby more than natives. And the general trend is actually for Hispanics to really match the birth rate of natives. That's something that incidentally is happening not just in the United States with Hispanics, but also across Latin America, which is where they originate from. It's really a very fascinating phenomenon across the entire continent. In terms of some of the other issues, the Canadian border is also heavily guarded, and it's also, targeted by border security. Although it is porous, and it is something that I think eventually will become a major issue if they ever build this wall across the border between the U.S. and Mexico. I doubt very much that the wall will ever be built in the way that it has been conceived. I think it's simply an impossibility. But let's just hypothetically say that it is. You will see that people will be using the eastern seaboard, the western seaboard, and the other land border very, very heavily. And that is why I think that we need realistic laws rather than just border security as the main agent of our fight against illegal immigration, because it's simply not realistic.
A friend of mine went to Canada last week and said that the border control there was very tight in the state of Washington.
I know. Last time I went there last time, maybe a couple of years ago, and I remember I had the same impression, yeah.
Let's take another quick call. We're very short on time. Renee in Miami. Hi there.
Gentlemen, great show, Bonnie. Thank you. Quick question. Correlation between immigrants, highly educated immigrants coming into the country, being able to maintain the traditional language spoken past the second, third generation. Is that something that has been studied? Are there any numbers on this?
Well, it depends really on how you look at immigrants. One, for instance, debate among academics is whether children of immigrants should be considered young children, very young children of immigrants should be considered immigrants or not if they have at least one parent who is now a U.S. Citizen. The majority, by the way, more than half of children who are immigrant today have at least one parent who is a citizen. In my view, that no longer constitutes the same thing as a first generation immigrant. So I think that we need to be very careful about that. In any case, there's definitely a lot of statistics, and I mentioned them in the book, that confirm that the second generation, so the children of immigrants, of first generation immigrants, the second generation immigrants are bilingual but speak English better than they speak Spanish. So their parents will probably speak Spanish better than English, but they will speak English better than they speak Spanish. And the third generation speaks only English, and there are, of course, exceptions, but this is an overwhelming statistic. It is true also of other groups, incidentally. It is true of Asians. It is true of, particularly groups like the Filipinos, who've always been a very important part of this equation, because that's a group that's been always very present in the United States. And I think that it should not be surprising at all, because when you are the child of an immigrant, you are very much aware that your parents are perceived, and you might be perceived as being an outsider. And the last thing you want to do is be perceived as an outsider. So there's this eagerness to really fit in.
Well, thank you so much, Alvaro Vargas Llosa, Senior Fellow of the Center on Global Prosperity at the Independent Institute, and the author of Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
And thanks for being with us. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction by Caroline Brader Watts. Also thanks to Peter J. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and discussion at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program deals with Florida Child Protective Services. An unusual number of recent fatalities have been documented while kids have been under state supervision. Also, Linda Gassenheimer, Fred Tasker and Company. To the calendar, on this day in 1535, 478 years ago, Pope Paul II excommunicates English King Henry VIII because of his divorce of Catherine of Aragon and subsequent marriage to Anne Boleyn. And on this day in 1882, 121 years ago, the first use of public electric lighting at Grand Central Station in New York City. One more while we ponder George McGovern in 1972. On this day, 1929, 84 years ago, the birth in St. Louis of Senator Thomas Eagleton. After he was nominated by Democrats for vice president in 1972, reports of psychiatric treatments surfaced, and he was forced to step down from the McGovern campaign. Kennedy family member Sergeant Shriver ran instead. Eagleton died in 2003, and we leave with a thought from King Henry VIII. At the end of his reign in 1547, after having six wives, quote, "Men's evil manners live in brass. Their virtues we write in water." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, stay with us and get ready for the Here and Now from NPR News.